Hey everybody, welcome to Gravel Kings. I am Ted King, professional cyclist and sometimes overcomer of detrimental jet lag.
Hi everyone, I'm Laura King, sometimes professional cyclist and also overcomer of jet lag.
Stu Streeter here, and I am age group cyclist and barbecuing dad. It's spring in NorCal. The sun is out. We're barbecuing. Laura, tell us more about this overcoming of jet lag.
Well, we're recording this on Wednesday, and it's just been a whirlwind of planes, trains, automobiles for me. After Seattle, we got on a plane. I got on a plane with the kids. We just was there for a few days, flew to Arizona for my little sister's bachelorette. A couple days later, flew back to Seattle. And then the next day following that, we took a flight all the way home to the East Coast, and then I to Boston, and then one more automobile the next morning for the final drive, 2.5 hour drive home. So I'm ready to just kind of stay put for a few days. How about you, Ted? Let's hear how my jet lag rivals your jet lag.
Well, I feel like, truth be told, mine isn't terrible. And maybe that comes with a bit of experience or just a heck of a lot of coffee. I bid you farewell. Children. Say that again.
Or no children.
Oh, yeah. Hands down, that makes a huge difference. That should have been my absolute preface. I bid you and the children farewell in California. I flew off to Portugal. I did a very, very long bike ride to the tune of 450 miles over 3 days. A little bit more than that. And then off to Spain, where I am now. So yeah, it's a little bit of hopping around time zones, but I feel okay with it and I am in no position to complain. So, you know what sounds really nice is going home, stoking up the barbecue. Stu, tell me what you are barbecuing these days.
Yeah, it's out west. So for us, it's like tri-tip is the beef that we barbecue out here. And do you guys have tri-tip in Vermont?
You know, it's the weirdest thing, and I'm yet to figure out why. And any wise barbecuer or butcher will tell me. We don't have tri-tip on the East Coast. And surely it exists under a different name. It's not like we have cows that just lack a particular muscle. But it's funny that it's a West Coast thing.
So listeners, you can fix us here, right? And tell us where we got this wrong. But my understanding is that the tri-tip comes from the same cut as a sirloin steak, and that out east, sirloins are really popular. So they chop up the tri-tip to make sirloin steaks. So if you go to a butcher and tell them, I want a sirloin, then they'll give you what is a tri-tip out west. So I think that's right. But I'm sure that one of our butchers who are listening can help correct things. For us, it's tri-tip if you're doing beef. And I'm a charcoal guy, so I've got like an old school round Weber. I actually have a number of them. It's a little ridiculous. And I like that. So it's spring is in the air out here. The sun finally came out and it's 80 degrees Fahrenheit and the grass is growing fast. And so, you know, switching gears to barbecue mode is nice.
Love it. Last time I was in New England, it was snowing, so I'm excited to go home and not play around in the snow and stoke up the barbecue.
Yeah.
Well, don't get too excited. It's I just rode in fog so thick it was basically raining, and it's pretty cold still.
But it's not snowing. It will not snow anymore. It's May 1st. We're not going to have snow anymore this year.
It snowed 3 days ago.
Like I said, it's May. It's not going to snow anymore.
He's speaking it into existence.
Yeah.
It has been a busy couple of weeks. Yeah, a busy couple of weeks for all of us. The last time we were all together, we were not together remotely. We were actually together in person, which was such a joy and a blast at Levi's Grand Fondo. We talked a bit about the race prior, but now having been on the back end of the race, what do you want to say about your races? And is this the future of road cycling in America?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I have, given my travel since then, I've run into a lot of people who were not there, and they were paying attention through the social medias and online medias. And a lot of folks are asking me what my impression was. And my impression is the weather is going to be a key takeaway characteristic. It was abysmal weather. It was that weather that Laura was just talking about. It was cold and wet and foggy and not the kind of weather that anyone wants to ride in. But that's not the take-home point. The real take-home point was, I think people really had fun. And I think the dynamic of the race was engaging and fun. And I mean, I don't want to go down the conversation of teams so much, but I mean, at the end of the day, it felt like a gravel race. And that was really fun, to use the word too many times. The condition of the road is such that the unfolding was kind of like a gravel race. Although ironically, maybe it's this hybrid gravel slash road because there was a breakaway that was characteristic of the day. Which is something that you don't often see in gravel. So I think that, in addition to, you know, the despite the weather, there was really good post-race vibes. That's where Stu and I hung out together, and you got me a beer very generously, despite my literal shivering body and thinking that maybe I shouldn't be spending too much time outside and maybe rushing to a shower. But yeah, a really interesting thing in its inaugural year. And I think the overall gist is that it was positive.
I 100% think there is going to be traction with this race. And I mentioned a couple episodes ago, or maybe the last episode, why I was not drawn to road racing. One of those reasons was kind of the lack of intrigue with the courses. Like, they're kind of, you know, often in kind of areas that weren't anything to write home about. And also, and for the women's races, like, weren't necessarily very long or challenging as the type of course that would really intrigue me. So when you look at Levi's, the course, I mean, 140 miles of true, like, world-class riding that's exciting and scenic and challenging, like, in crazy challenging, but also really rewarding. That's the type of course that's, you know, it draws interest, because no matter what kind of day you're having, you got to look around and just think, this is amazing to be riding these roads and to be seeing the ocean views and to be seeing the green, super bright green pastures with cows. And I'm only 1 hour from San Francisco. I mean, it's truly just the course alone is set apart in my mind. My day didn't quite go as planned. So I am, you know, I ended up having a mechanical, and what I said to a friend was, a race ending mechanical. And what I said to a friend was, well, gosh, if you listened to the last episode and you heard about all my anxiety about the race, I felt like I wasted a lot of energy with that anxiety. Now, having never really seen it through to the other end, but we can talk about how that, I guess it was a learning for the next week. So anyway, that said, would I like to go back next year? Would I encourage other people to go to this race? And I think it's going to continue to gain traction? I definitely do. And gosh, this was such an anomaly with the weather that more likely than not next year, they're going to have a beautiful, typical Sonoma County day of sunshine. And I think that's going to make quite the difference for everybody's experience.
Yeah. And from my perspective, I did the short course. There must've been 6 or 7 different course options, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. And so I did like the third shortest course called Geysers. And essentially we raced out on the same course as you guys on the long course. And then you all took a left, was it maybe 10, 12 miles in, I would guess, less than 20. And then we hung a right and essentially raced till the 40-mile mark to the base of the climb. And it was really interesting the way our race played out as well, because it's technically not a race for us as age groupers, but we had number plates. There were timing chips. There were waves there, you know, I mean, it was a race. Mm-hmm. Everybody was racing. And so it was pretty strung out for the first 20, 30 miles. And then we got to the first rest stop and it was like, you didn't really know what was happening. And the guys driving the pace, which happened to be big, tall Wayne for listeners.
I ran into him this morning.
Did you really? Okay. Yeah. So Big Tall Wayne is Pete Stetna's mechanic, and Big Tall Wayne, if you've been to a gravel race, you know, Big Tall Wayne, and Big Tall Wayne is just sitting on the front, just stamping out 26, 28 mile an hour pace in a big baggy, like North Face jacket.
That's awesome. Like,
basically street clothes, just stamping out, you know, 400 watts or whatever. And we get to the base of the first climb and he's like, all right, peace out. See you guys. And I think he was just going to wait at the feed because that became one of you guys' feed zones.
Oh, that's amazing. And
so here, you know, he had shattered the group and there's maybe 20 of us left. And then we all, you know, got together and then climbed up the climb. But what I will say is it really played out like a gravel race, even on the shorter course. There weren't a lot of road tactics going on. There wasn't a lot of team partnerships happening. It was just a good, hard race.
Yeah.
And guys were riding hard, rotating through, and then we hit the base of this monstrous climb, and then it was like everybody just climbed at their pace and then raced the rollers back in. So I agree with you, man. That was, I probably did 200 road races as a young man, and I had more fun at Levi's, even in awful weather, than I've had on a road bike in a really long time at a race. So way to go, Levi's. I think it's a hit.
Yeah. Well, we'll take two next year.
Yeah, exactly. We'll try again and hope for that good weather and no mechanicals. I'm sorry for that, Laura. Sure was fun to see you though at the finish and, you know, hang out a bit.
Oh yeah. It's just everything about that whole week. It's hard to feel too negative about what happened when, you know, everything, we're just like hanging out in a place we love. We're around friends, going out to dinner with you, Stu, going on a fun shakeout ride.
Yeah.
Prior, so no complaints. We had a fabulous trip up there.
The next event up for you guys was Sea Otter, and Laura, talk about a turn of events for you. I actually have your Strava open and am, you know, voyeuristically looking at your Strava. It is like 65 segments of PR, 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 and you shaved 30 minutes off your fastest time. What in the world?
Thanks, Stu. I have a lot of things that I am pleased about and also just excited to kind of build upon post theater. And, you know, first and foremost, I'm thinking back to the anxiety I had before at Levi's. And I said to Ted, it's strange, but I don't have the same level of anxiety about lining up for this race. And I didn't know exactly why, but, you know, thinking about it, I think a lot of it had to do with an all women's start. And I love the fact that, I mean, love, hate the fact that this race starts on a hill. So it's, you know, it separates things out right away and that just feels safer. But it's also, I mean, it's a painful way to you're basically, I mean, I felt like my lungs were actually bleeding by the top and I haven't had that sensation in a really long time and maybe should add a little more of that intensity to my training. But I did tell Ted on the drive over to the race start, I said, I think I want to take about 30 minutes off my time. And he said, how are you going to do that? And I said,
I did not have that intonation. Start. I was curious, okay, how do you plan on doing that?
Okay, he was curious. And I said, I'm going to have a better start. And I really, truly felt like, Laura, if you can just fight a little harder up this main climb and get better positioning. The backup was insane last year. There was so much of the first loop where I was just stuck and you had to, you know, the only way to get around people was to put out way too much power and effort. And so, yeah, that was my main goal, and it worked. I had much better positioning, and just, it was a whole different kind of race experience for me. I felt like it was the most dynamic I've ever been able to race, where there's, you know, attacks going and you're able to follow and working on just staying with those attacks, recovering, pacing with other people. And so it was fun to really feel like I was in the mix. I rode the whole first loop with Petta, who we met at Levi's, who's a like very decorated Australian cyclist. So really cool to be racing around her. And then
17 time national champion.
Yes.
17.
I wasn't kidding about decorated.
Yeah, I'll say.
Yeah. So rode most of the first loop with her, and then another woman named Carolyn, who is in the Lifetime Grand Prix. And it was just a real, it's a pleasure to race with other women. It's a pleasure to see real race tactics playing out and to feel like it's such an elevated feel to be amongst, you know, 40 of in the world now, and to see what that's like. And to, I felt like I learned more about mountain bike racing on that day. And Petta, Carolyn, and me each had very different strengths, and so it was cool to see how those played out and to try to follow when you're the weaker one, and to try and set a pace when you know you're the stronger one, depending on where your strengths are. So I guess that's kind of my summary. I took in as many calories as I could. I felt my only concern after the first loop was, after putting out so much effort with surging and such and feeling really strong, I was like, can I hold this together for the second loop? My first loop was 2:32. And, you know, I ended up finishing in like 5:20. So I would love to see what might be possible next year. Should I be able to hang on to the speed of the first loop a little bit better? And yeah, all in all, I'm just like, to be in the middle of the pack with my current kind of like age and place in life and things that I have going on, I'm like delighted, but I also am like kind of motivated after that to see how to build on it.
Well, and to put some of that in context for listeners, Laura, like at Levi's, Aaron DiCrescenzo goes on to solo win it and just obliterates the field and wins. You came in 4 minutes ahead of her at XL Fuego at Sea Otter. She was two places behind you. And right behind you, 4 minutes, she and Emily Newsom came in together, who, I mean, these are world-class hitters, and you beat them both by 4 minutes. So I don't know what their day was, and I don't want to hear excuses about them, but like Lauren, who crushed everybody a week prior, you beat by 4 minutes. So you should be.
Thanks, Stu. I will say one thing I really admire about Lauren DiCrescenzo is, you know, she is so dominant in the road and gravel scene, and mountain biking is not her forte, but she continues to put herself out there to try and build on her weaknesses. And that's a real strength to be able to, you know, she doesn't have to do that. She could just put herself into the position in races where she knows she's going to continue to win or set records. And instead to put yourself in a position where, you know, you're not maybe going to be there battling for the podium, but just wanting to learn and get, you know, to build on your weaknesses is something that not everybody would do. So kudos to her. Yeah. This is probably the only time I will ever be ahead of her in a race result. But, I just think really highly of her. And Emily, I know too, is her mountain bike doesn't get a lot of practice, but two really strong women.
And really the same could be said of yours, Ted. I mean, you look at the list of lifetime Grand Prix athletes and other athletes in the mix there. And I mean, you killed it at XL Fuego. Did you come away feeling really satisfied? And
Overall, yes. I mean, I appreciate the praise. I think I killed it in every which way beside getting a tangible result. Which is a hard metric not to ignore. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Lawrence Ten Dam recently, and he was talking about how often people will talk about their results in terms of a power number. And so, for example, what I look at is, yeah, much like Laura, I was really happy to go considerably faster this year than last year. I went 20 minutes quicker. And I look at my power, and I was 40 watts higher average power over the course of the day. And okay, that's going to attribute to a heck of a faster ride. And I felt really smooth all throughout the day. But it's almost as though he's saying, okay, just purely look at result, purely look at result. Whereas I'm thinking, okay, if you're anything but in first place, then who cares? Like if you're in second place, you wanted to get first. If you're in 22nd place, you wanted to get 20th or 10th or first. And so it's not a... It's such a funny number to look at because absolute power doesn't matter. It's all power relative to your other results. But as long as you can see tangible improvement, I think that's what's considerably or very valuable, I should say. So I'm really happy with my day. I didn't anticipate a fantastic result. And in the first 5 minutes, as we go up that abysmal, super steep wall on the car track, I was just going backwards, which is a funny contrast also to the year before where I thought that section was easy. And I don't know what is attributable to those differences. But overall, I was really happy. I mean, like Laura was talking about being a two lap race, there's almost this mental piece going in, it's like, oh, it's only two laps. But to remain consistent, I was really happy with how consistent I was lap one to lap two. It's an easy thing to, I find it very easy to check out because as much as it is quote unquote only two laps, you come in after your first lap thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so empty. How am I going to go do that again? And I just happened to be in a really good group, and 3, 4, 5 of us probably swelled as much as to 6, 7, and then shrunk down to ultimately about 3 of us at the finish. It was great. So this is the long-winded way of saying it was a fantastic training day. It's not a day that I'm ever going to get a magnificent result. As people have probably heard me say before, mountain bikers will cry that Sea Otter is a roadie race, and roadies will say, no, it's a mountain bike race. And all I have to do is look at results and see something like 18 of the top 20 are mountain bikers.
Right. I was going to mention, it's just a who's who of mountain bike professionals mm-hmm. in that, mm-hmm. even that top 25.
Sure.
Just.
So overall, great
question. You mentioned you rode with a group all day. Hmm. How much of a difference do you think it makes in your result riding with others versus if you were to have been separated and been in kind of like no man's land by yourself?
Huge difference. So partially is the drafting and the efficiency, and you can take a big hard pull. If, especially at that point in a race, like halfway through the race and on, if you're feeling empty, I feel like it's such an invitation to give up. Especially when I'm not in contention for a result, it'd be like, oh, this kind of hurts, I'm going to just go easier. Oh, this hurts, I'm going to go easier. Look over your shoulder. Oh, you see somebody coming, I'm just going to wait for them. Whereas I can constantly make it hurt a little bit more in order to suffer to stay with a group, knowing that, I don't know, knowing it's good for me, knowing it gets me to the finish line quicker, knowing it gets me a better result. So
that was my complete takeaway as well.
Yeah.
Just like how that it carries so much momentum.
Now, what I'm really curious about is if they're ever going to do any poison oak mitigation. Laura.
Did you see Finsty?
Yeah. Finsky's legs are smoked. I mean, it looks like he took a weed whacker with his shorts and went weed whacking in the poison oak. I'm not that bad, but I have it. Dude, all said really? And done, I probably had it in 8 places throughout my body. And just the tiniest little patch, right? So you can sort of deal with it, and then you rub up against a different part of your body, and then that part hurts. I mean, here I am. What, has it been 2 weeks? And I still have... I'm itching pretty badly. So, yeah, Laura, do you have it?
It was pretty minimal, but I feel like I am maybe one of the least sensitive to poison oak for my history. Hmm. But it's a real thing. I mean, I was just listening to... there was just a really big ultra marathon, trail marathon in Auburn, California, over this past weekend that I followed. And they were also talking about the prolific poison oak issue and needing to kind of mitigate that somehow. So it can be, I mean, there's some people that are so sensitive that they like breathe near it and they have to go to the hospital.
Yeah, 'tis the season in Northern California. I mean, from the Bay Area all the way on up right now in NorCal, we've got poison oak everywhere and it is awful. So
it's horrible.
Yeah. Hey, talk more, guys, if you don't mind, for my education's purposes. In my mind, I'm thinking two pro cyclists to shave 20 minutes and 30 minutes respectively off your time is in this world of marginal gains. That seems unbelievable to me in a 4-hour race. Do you guys attribute that to, my head is going to nutrition and this trend towards super high carb intake. Are there other mitigating things going on here that I'm unaware? Cause I'm being told that the XL Fuego course this year was actually 2 to 3 minutes longer per lap than last year. So it's not like you Correct. Went faster cause the course was shorter. How in the world are two elite professionals shaving 20% off their time year to year? You guys are incredible.
Well, I'll speak to my experience. I think it's a confluence of factors. I think, like I already mentioned, placement plays a big role, just considering I got pretty backed up last year. I think the company you end up riding with, for me, played a massive role in keeping my momentum and keeping my speed and keeping something, you know, a carrot to constantly chase is just so motivating. So I think fitness was a very small piece. But overall, like not just talking about me, but just looking at the entire women's field, everyone is leveling up because I think, I don't know the exact stats, but I think Sophia was 15 minutes faster than her win last year.
Whoa.
Wow.
I think she was around 5 hours and this year she was 4:45. So, and you know, the rest of the field also was, there was a lot of discussion about like just what is happening in not just in cycling racing, in women's cycling. Everyone is improving and getting faster rapidly. So it's a challenge to kind of like, everybody needs to kind of step up their game, I guess, to stay competitive. And I think nutrition plays a huge role in that. I mean, this goes for just following this ultra marathon race over the weekend and listening to so many people talk about this high carb movement, but there is so much momentum and education now around what is possible in the amount of carbohydrate you can absorb in an hour and maximizing the amount of nutrition that you get in and how much that is becoming a game changer performance. And that was so fascinating to listen to a podcast about this 100K ultra marathon and hear the same narrative happening where times are being blown apart, course records being broken, times faster than they ever have been. The women's winner of the 100K was 6th place overall in the men and women. So just amazing things happening. And a lot of this is credited to nutrition. So I think that's something we can't ignore.
It's cool to hear that Sophia knocked 15 minutes off because the whole time you were beginning what you were saying, I was thinking we're making macro, we're optimizing macro gains, whereas the front of the Peloton is doing much more micro. I can't picture Keegan knocking 20 minutes off his time year over year like I knocked off 20 minutes. I'm cutting with an axe and not a scalpel. Like last year, I got a flat towards the end of the race. And so, okay, it is not insignificant to say that I went 40 watts higher because I also removed that as a factor. In my lap over lap, my power was much higher this year, which was rewarding personally.
40 watts?
Yeah. Which has, I mean, but that has a great deal to do with consistency and the training that I've put in this year that I'm quite pleased with. It has so much to do with just the mental space too, of just being like, I'm going to stay on the gas instead of I'm going to go easier. This hurts, but I'm going to keep going. Instead of this hurts, I'm going to go easier. Can't for an instant discount what Laura's saying about nutrition. I don't think I was doing any sort of massive carbohydrates last year. So, yeah, just racing smarter, racing harder, and being able to cut 20 minutes. Could I cut off another 20 minutes in 2025? I would be hard-pressed to think I can do that. And so much has to do with what group you latch onto, and so much of this race, actually, it's quite feasible. So much of the race has to do with where you enter the single track, which takes place, I forget, 2 minutes into the race.
And it was later this year, right? So you did get to kind of sort some things out. Would you say that's accurate or
no? I wouldn't. Okay. So whereas last year, it was the same start line and we started with a little bit of gravel that is on the side of the pavement. And then you go up, up, up into the single track. This was purely sticking to the paved section. And I don't know what it was. There's something about last year where I just sort of got caught up in the draft, which sounds ridiculous going up a 20% paved climb, but I just felt like it was easy. And this year, oh my goodness, I was dying 1,000 deaths going up there. Whereas if I could somehow have latched onto a group, I mean, shoot, I finished 33rd, I think. So if I had gone in, and I probably went in 40th, if I had gone in 20th, I would probably finish in the 20s.
You finished 32nd, by the way.
Oh, phew.
Don't sell yourself short. You beat Stefano Barbary. He was 33rd.
Oh, man. Stefano and I raced against each other in 2006 to show our age.
On the road, right?
Yeah. We were domestic road pros. Anyway, great question.
Well,
long-winded answer.
In speaking about all the ways we're trying to optimize our performance, how did you optimize your recovery post-race?
Well, I rushed home because I wanted to get in the shower and wash off the poison oak that I had on me. I also knew that
like a 30 minute drive to.
So I finished the race
to the listeners.
Talk to Stefano for 2 minutes. Go sit in the recovery booth that Lifetime has going on for about 2 more minutes, and then think. Now I need to get home to relieve the babysitter, so that I can bring the kids back here so as to relieve Laura, who will be finishing in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes, whatever it is.
This is real life, huh?
So, yeah, sprint back to the Airbnb 30 minutes away. The kids are actually asleep, and of course, that's the kind of thing you want to optimize, given that we're about to deprive them of sleep, given the travel schedule they have coming up. So that allowed me to time to shower and begin to... Actually, I didn't even have to pack a bike, which was a miracle. Thank you, Anna Gritis of SRAM, who agreed to ship my bike home. But yeah, just pack up and get ready to clear out the Airbnb, get the kids dressed and back in the car, a little bit of snackage, and then out to the venue again. Whereupon, met up with Laura, who apparently used just a facial wipe and towel to clean the poison oak off her to not be... Oh, wait. I think something to do with the poison oak, not that I have it on like my head and shoulders, but I think being 6'3" and going through all these tiny tunnels of brush. Oh my gosh. I just loathed being tall while doing that race.
I feel so bad for you being tall. That must just be such a terrible predicament. I
itch everywhere.
As a short king over here, I feel no pain for you.
Then we... got on Find My Friends and searched all over the venue in order to get to the Saris expo booth and drank some beer and had a sip of whiskey because there was a whiskey tasting, and took some fun photos and had a great time with the full family. Laura was there hanging out at Saris. That's how I
recap. I feel like your recounting of this story sounds so much more peaceful than it really felt for, I think, both of us. It felt a lot more stressful as you're texting me worried about you're going to be late to the booth and you don't know where the booth is, and you're emailing Sarah saying, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to be a little bit late, and I'm coming as fast as I can. And I just finished the race, and you're telling me, can you get to the booth so that we're both not late? And I'm thinking, I need to eat something after this 5.5 hour race so that I'm not falling over. And so I'm like standing in a food line trying to quickly just get anything. I just feel like this is crazy. In my mind, like, this is the opposite of optimizing recovery. This is going from like the, all you want to do after that kind of effort is just sit down. I felt like I was going to fall over and faint and sit down and like drink a recovery shake or something. And instead it's like, nope. A little more complex with the whole family trying to make it to the booth. But anyway,
I just need to be your groupie next year at Sea Otter, guys. And I'll be there with recovery shakes and Tech New.
Yeah. There's
an oak wash, and I'll just hover and be your groupie. So
yes, please.
Problem solved. Well, so from there, after XL Fuego, which you both had just incredible days and a great weekend at Sea Otter, it's not done yet. Like, you guys then went all kinds of other crazy. So who wants to walk us through the next week? Ted off, obviously, to Europe for Portugal and Spain, and Laura up to Seattle and Arizona, and then Seattle, and then Boston, and then Vermont. Did I get that right?
You did. Good work. Well, my story is not probably as interesting as it relates to cycling adventures, so I won't give you all the details about my trip. However, I will say, solo parenting, thank goodness I was meeting my family. They're incredibly helpful to me. And I was still able to sneak in some Pacific Northwest rides, two of them being in the pouring down rain. I do keep an older bike in Seattle since we head there frequently, and you know, it has carbon wheels and rim brakes. And I was quickly reminded that I'm really glad bike technology has improved, because in the rain, turns out you need a lot of room for stopping with carbon wheels and rim brakes. But yeah, just great to see family. I had, you know, my little sister had a bachelorette party in Arizona, as I mentioned, and so no shortage of kind of just jumping from one thing to the next. Ted's adventures, tell us about them, because they're a little more exciting.
Well, the funny thing about you going to your bachelorette party is my wild gallivanting around the globe adventure, I don't think would exist were it not for your sister's bachelorette party. Because for all intents and purposes, that is not a event that you can miss. So it was posed to me.
That was on the calendar first.
Well, sure. And so therefore I get an invitation to go to Portugal, and the Portugal snippet of time was going to be directly after Sea Otter. So it involved hopping on a plane straight away, but that was a very positive experience. It was a great training experience. It's the kind of thing that you would have a hard time saying, sorry, Ted, you can't go to that. And then that allowed me to go to the Troca, which I don't think I would fly over to Europe exclusively for the Troca. So this awesome adventure upon which I am currently in the midst of wouldn't take place were it not for you being in Arizona, drinking champagne and going to a PJ party. I mean, it's hilarious because I think, truth be told, you wanted to do the Troca even more than I did. I mean,
I did.
Yeah, like I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm over the moon to be here. And there's a lot of friends from all over the world. This is a very, very international event. But yeah, it's like, I don't think it was even on my radar nearly as much as it was yours. So making the most of this experience. Yeah, we had a great time in Portugal. It was a Lawrence Tendam and I led a really long trip, literally across the entire country, north to south, which is sort of akin to the 200 on 100 adventures that I've done a whole handful of times, or the coast ride that we have done a whole handful of times. And then we wrapped that up and I flew to Barcelona and then on up to Girona, which is a really fun place to be back. I mean, this is a place that I called home for 5 years over a 7 year period, where the middle two, I was in Italy for a pair of years. But just to see this town again, to see how much the town has changed, to see the influx of cycling culture, maybe even to the point of a detriment to locals. I mean, we talked about being in Mallorca and being sort of annoyed as a local by all the cycling tourists. I literally tonight, you might have seen me in this Zoom call go back and forth across rooms. There is a protest in town tonight against cyclists.
What?
Yeah, okay. True story. And I'm on a really loud, echoey street. And when they're saying, down with cyclists, I'm saying, I need to do a podcast about cycling. I'm kidding about that. I mean, it's a very peaceful protest. But I think it's no coincidence that we're here during probably the busiest week of the year for cycling. And it's sort of a, hey, keep us in mind kind of thing. That's the extent at which I know it. I don't know anymore, so throw me a bone there. But yeah, I mean, it's cool to see this event. I feel like it's the European Unbound in that it's the biggest, longest running event on the gravel side. I want to say it started in 2019. They've really done a great job diversifying all throughout the week. So today is Wednesday. Let's work in theoreticals first. The 560 kilometer race goes off today. That's 330 miles, 260 miles, something like that. But a big long day, and it goes up into the Eastern Pyrenees. Tomorrow is Thursday, so that's an event where you watch people come in all day, and then there's sponsor events all throughout the week. Friday, the 360K, which is about 200 miles, that'll go off, and then our race, 200K, 120-ish miles, goes off on Saturday. Now, if that was theoreticals, the reality is we've had rain all week, and not just a little bit of rain, but like downright deluge. And it's very atypical to have it this time of year, and it's been problematic. They literally canceled the 560 kilometer race, which is really interesting because...
Wait, what? I thought they just delayed it.
They delayed it a day, and then they canceled it today.
Oh, yeah, I just put it out on that. Instagram just a few, maybe an hour or two ago.
No.
Yeah, which is, it's dramatic, right? It's people have invested so flights and travel. And I was thinking today, before I even knew they canceled it, think about all the folks who maybe couldn't do it when they delayed it a day. It's like, okay, I already had my escape plan. I have to go back to work or a wedding or whatever it is the following day. I can't do a race 24 hours later. Okay. Low likelihood of that already, given that this is a midweek race and probably a place that people are going to use as a vacation week-long getaway, but still, it's a reality. So ultimately, I feel like it's sort of a darned if you do, darned if you don't situation. They canceled it to avoid treacherous weather up north. They first took it out of the Pyrenees, where you're up at 2,000 meters, 6,000 feet, and they're getting feet of snow up there. And then the 560 is what they call an adventure ride. They don't call it a race. Obviously, much to Stu's point, as soon as there's numbers on your bike, you're racing, and other people lined up. It was a race. There's some very fast people who are doing it. The guy who won Tour Divide was going to do it, for example. The guy that I was duking it out with at Unbound XL, he's here. So, and they, I mean, a heck of a lot of people is my point. And then I look at Unbound and I look at the frame that I ruined and the drivetrain I ruined and the thousands upon thousands of dollars that I alone had to literally put into the trash, let alone the other dozens or hundreds of people who had to do the same. So the promoters are allowing people to get out of that problem. They've offered them the opportunity to ride the 360K race, which is Friday morning. There were many river crossings and all sorts of dangerous situations that they've gotten out of. I mean, I think of it with my race promoter hat on, like, what a relief. I guarantee it's just a relief for them to say, we are not going to have this race. Yes, we're going to deal with the wrath of people who are going to think this is a bad decision, but ultimately they can rely on this is for rider safety, and that's a hard thing to argue against. So, again, darned if you do, darned if you don't. It is a bummer. It's terrific that it's not the only race. I don't know.
Well, and this is I think it's a fascinating turn and maybe a precedent in some regards, at least that I'm not aware has happened prior at a gravel event mm-hmm. where they've actually canceled for bad weather. That, I mean, I wasn't at Unbound last year, but I followed closely, like every other gravel cyclist, the unfolding of that awful mud that you guys endured at mile 10 and the XL. I mean, you were just slogging for hours. And then the wrath and the blowback on the event of why did they not just reroute that mm-hmm. one section to avoid that horrible mud pit? And you had the two sides of the argument, right? We don't cancel, we don't change versus, hey, you got people here that are just destroying equipment. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting precedent. And what is your take, you guys? Like, do you think they should reroute events and shorten and change and cancel to avoid these sort of conditions? Or do you think there's a honor in, nope, this is the course, we're doing the course, survive or don't survive?
Whoa, that's so hard. I guess I'm not a traditionalist enough to say your second point. We do it no matter what. And when the start gun goes, we do it no matter what. I am empathetic to ruining and the cost of ruining parts. I'm empathetic to the race promoter who has to figure out how to please all people, knowing that they're not going to please all the people. I guess my heart of hearts, I tend to lean towards the former and setting a new precedent for having a different perspective on what to do with weather.
Yeah, I guess to some extent, like, I mean, I think back to Grasshopper, King Ridge a couple of years ago, all three of us were at.
Yeah.
And they had an issue on land permissions, remember? Mm-hmm. And then I think it was early that morning, everybody gets an email, hey, sorry, we got to reroute some things. And I'm sure there were people, I'm sure it was a darned if you do, darned if you don't kind of thing, but everybody had a great time. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the relationship with that native tribe was hopefully strengthened as a result of humbly, you know, apologizing, and it's good for cycling. And I don't know, it seemed like I was there for the event. And when I got the email that morning that the route is different, it's like, oh, all right, whatever. Okay. Download a new GPS route. Okay. We're going to do a different ride. Oh, mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah. I feel like something like Tour Divide is not going to change its course or delay its date, right? It's like, here's the set out date. Go do the race. If you want to just time trial it, then do it 2 days later and skip the first day tornado or whatever it is.
Well, there's also no one liable at the end of the day for that race.
Right, because Tour Divide is just like this open.
No organizer necessarily, you know? It's, yeah it's like self-run almost.
Okay.
I don't know.
I agree with that, but then there's a lot of bike packing. I mean, I guess I'm sort of thinking just bike pack. Traditional bike packers are not going to look for an easy escape route, right? I mean, right. Something like VTX, Vermont Super 8, that's run by Vermont bike packers, and that's a legit thing. Or any bike packing event outside of Tour Divide, which is this sort of anomalous, funny, autonomous thing. Whereas I think throwing a little bit of empathy towards the safety and well-being of riders, I think makes sense. So yeah, why couldn't they have rerouted the 560? I don't know. And admittedly, yeah, the storm stops here theoretically tomorrow, which is a Thursday, and then Friday and Saturday is going to be nice weather. I don't know.
Yeah, I have to trust they have a solid good reason. I guess when it comes to thinking about Unbound last year, I also tend to put on my race director hat and think what is going to result in the greatest percentage of people having a good experience at this race, especially one where many folks, it's been a bucket list event for so long, and they're traveling far and investing a lot to be here. And with all those factors at play, I don't think if they're ever concerned about, you know, diluting the course in some way and not making it hard enough, I don't think there are so many factors that make that race challenging that I don't think that rerouting is going to suddenly make it too easy. I mean, I feel like Lifetime has been, you know, they've kind of had the mindset that this is supposed to be hard. This is supposed to be a challenge, and it's going to be no matter what. But at the expense of like reducing the experience for the majority of the age group riders who have long wanted to come and experience Unbound. I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure keeping the mud part of the mud section in was the right call. That's my own perspective.
Well, and I can say as an age grouper, like at least from the local events, that you can wait till the weekend before to register. And I recognize that's, you know, a narrow lane of events. I don't register for a local event until the week prior if it's within driving distance and there's a potential of mud. Because I'm just not going to go do 8 hours slogging around in the mud. And to your point, Ted, I can't swing the $600 drivetrain it's going to cost me to put 100 miles through the mud. And so I just wait and then reg. So there may be a division here too among, you know, elite level and age group level that, you know, I don't know, maybe that's splitting too many hairs, but and that's not going to apply at Unbound or Mid-South or some of these other national events where it's a lottery to get in the first place. You're not going to book a flight a week before. So I there's just, you know, what do you do?
Darned if you do, darned if you don't.
Yeah, it really is good. Well, hey, what's next, guys? What's coming up? I mean, obviously, you've got the Traca this weekend, Ted. And for the listeners, I know I didn't know anything about the Traca, which maybe I'm the only one who's been living under that rock. But I did a little bit of research.
Did you stumble upon the article? There's an article in Velo News that was like the 5 reasons you should care about the Traca. And I think they make a good point. And I think I was in the same camp as you. It's like, I've heard of the event and I was peripherally aware of it being the quote Unbound of Europe. I think it's cool to see this development of European gravel, and it has a pretty stacked start list and it's a really, really dynamic course. I think we often think of middle America racing where it's super long distances and pretty long straights in the plains, and this is single track. It is all kinds of types of gravel and sand and mud, and because of all the rain, like massive water pits and puddles and super steep stuff and hair-raising descents. And it's a really, really cool course in the few miles that I've ridden, which is a funny thing because, you know, I live here for, like I said, 5 years. And I bet in that time I rode a few miles of gravel, and I've already ridden way, way, way more gravel in my time here. So, yeah.
Is it a zoo there right now, like a la Sea Otter? Like that kind of vibe?
Sea Otter is so concentrated, and then you have, what, 10,000 people in the inner circle of a, of fences. It feels like that amid tourists in a medieval downtown.
Really? Oh, cool.
It's bizarre, to be honest. It is so busy with so many languages and so touristy, and every other person on a bike or every other person curious why there are so many cyclists here. It's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, I recommend it, but I think it's growing exponentially, right? It was popular last year and it's going to be gangbusters next year.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's a hoot. What do you got coming up, Stu? Where are you going?
Man, I'm going to Wild West Gravel Grinder, which is just an hour and a half, 2 hours north, up in Red Bluff, California. This is a really cool event. I want to say it's their fifth year. Really hard courses. A lot of wide open spaces. A big, big, huge climb. Like a 3,000 foot climb in the middle of the day, and then two more to come. Yeah, it's a 9,000 foot day for the 100 miler. I think it's 12,000 feet for the 130 ish miler for the pros. But that's a great day. Crazy. I've done it a couple of times, and it's for a really cool cause for Compassion International. And I think it's, I believe it's $30 for every registration goes directly to Compassion. To do some really incredible work in the Philippines. So a really cool cause. And they had awful mud last year. And so I think their registrations are suffering. So NorCal people, the weather looks amazing the next 10 days. Join me at the Wild West. It's going to be a good one. So should be hard and fast. And try and get a belt buckle.
That sounds like a really fun event that I would like to go to sometime. But when you said the weather is really good, I know I saw that Bike Monkey, poor Bike Monkey who runs Levi's and is running the Boggs 8-hour mountain bike event this weekend has shortened the race due to another day of totally inclement weather. So
really,
are you getting any rain or is?
No, it's been beautiful and sunny up here. And Red Bluff is another 2 hours north of Sacramento. So where's the bog happening? Do you know where that happens?
Bog's Demonstration Forest. It's somewhere northeast of
San Francisco.
The Healds, Sonoma County area. So it's, hour and a half northeast, I think.
Yeah, Mendocino, Clear Lake. That's a whole different microclimate there, and they do get rain into the late year. But no, it's been gorgeous here. Now, I've been out of town a lot the last week, but the last couple of days that I've been back, it's been nice. And I looked at the 10-day forecast today for Red Bluff, and it looked sunny. So should be good. Yeah, should be fast and hard and be good.
Well, we have... let's see, Ted gets home and then the next week we are so happy to be home this year to be able to attend Ride for Mo Wilson's memorial event, which is taking place in the near the Kingdom Trails in northern Vermont. And so we're home for May in Vermont and then we're off to serious sunshine at Gravalocos and Hyco, Texas and Unbound.
Getting into the meat of the season, right?
It is crazy. Today's May 1st. Unbound is 1 month away. There are a lot of great races that we have on the calendar afterwards. It's hard not to put a big red circle around June 1st and Unbound. So I knew it was going to happen last October when I said, okay, let's take this year and treat it seriously. I knew the year was going to go by quickly. And it's just fascinating how quickly it really has, you know? Long days, fast months, as they say in bike racing or in parenting.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, hey, should we get some questions? We got some really good ones coming in.
Yeah, let's do it.
Anything more you want to say about what's next before? Otherwise?
Nope. Let's go straight to questions.
Brandon Babcock sends in this one. I'm very much enjoying the new podcast. Questions for you folks. I'm venturing into more and more long gravel rides and planning to do some overnight bike packing. Do you have recommendations when it comes to bike packing gear, like must-haves, things to avoid, overrated equipment, etc.? I think we've all got a little experience in this territory. This would be fun.
Yeah, this is a hard one to answer because it's so much more of a conversation. Like, the first thing that I would say is a good cycling computer. And that would spawn an interesting conversation of maybe traditionalists would be like, bike computer, you don't need that. Just go venture out into the woods. Or, hey, Ted, I already have a cycling computer because I'm getting into bike packing. So what's the next thing that you would recommend? And at that point, maybe it's the right sleeping bag or sleeping pad or bivy. I wrote a pretty lengthy equipment list of all the stuff that I took on Tour Divide, which is a pretty extreme example of what to do when bike packing. So without a better answer, I'm going to say, if you're going to get into bike packing, get yourself a nice saddle, because you're probably spending a lot of time in the saddle and you want to have a comfy tush, or to that end, a great chamois, and therefore a wonderful sponsor plug to get yourself some nice Veloccio bibs, who is renowned for their comfortable chamois.
I think one item, though my experience is quite limited in overnight bike packing, one item that I think is not overrated is having a Garmin InReach. And that is just, or I have so many friends and who have maybe gotten into situations that have, you know, where conditions have turned and things have gotten a little dicey. And I think having someone who can follow you and can be your emergency contact or be able to keep tabs on you should anything go awry is invaluable, especially given the fact that you're probably in areas where there's not a lot of cell coverage and cell service.
Yeah, I think that's so important, Laura. I just think back to our ride when we were all together up around Mount Rainier, and the last day you guys were trying to hustle to get home to your kids. Mm-hmm. And I flatted on the descent and couldn't get the plugs didn't work. And then my CO2, it was just having a nightmare. And so it was my last day and I thought, well, I'll just ride it in flat. No big deal. But there was no cell reception. So I couldn't text you guys to say, hey, I'm good. Just roll. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about me. And so poor Ted had to turn around and ride all the way back up to me. And are you good? Yeah, I'm good. Just go. And so had I had an InReach, because you guys did, I probably could have sent you a message. But yeah, so I mean, obviously emergencies, you want to have it for emergencies. But even for the convenience of being able to text the people you're with when you don't have cell signal, I think is huge, right?
And maybe you need a ham radio for that, because the messages, they're not unreliable. InReach is a wonderful thing. I know some folks who have had problems getting messages out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it's not as quick as texting. You might hit text. The message to say, hey, I'm on the side of the road with a flat tire. Don't worry about me. You guys can go along. And maybe we'd get the message 2 hours later. So maybe in a perfect world, that's working great. And I'm not in any way disrespecting Garmin, because it is an invaluable product. And I'm a huge fan. That explains why I have two of them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And I wouldn't say that's the norm, that it's a 2 hour delay. I mean, there's been plenty of times on that backcountry mountain bike trip in the San Juan Mountains where I sent messages and they went through right away.
Mm-hmm. Stu, what you got? What do you want to bring?
You know, two things I would throw in that may not be on the radar, a little less obvious. One is, for years I used one of those seat pack bike packing, you know, big, large 8 liter seat bags that go around your seat and do it, and they slosh around. And I say, if your bike will accept it, just put a rack on the back. And then you can use any, you know, waterproof bag that you would use for bike packing or backpacking or camping. So you have a little bit more versatile piece of equipment. Mm-hmm. And just put a rack on there. And then you can stash your stuff sack, roll that thing down, and then strap it to a rack. And I've done that on one of my gravel bikes that works great as a bike packer. And I just think, like, there's a reason people have put racks on bikes for years. I don't mess as much with the specific seat bag, like a handlebar bag, great, frame bag, but the seat bag, I think just do a rear rack. And then the other thing I would say is, I'm sure there's a ton of brands and I'm not endorsing any particular brand, but don't spray DEET on your cycling clothing. It absolutely destroys your Lycra, eats it alive. So use, and I'm looking here to be sure I get it right, so listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but Picardin is, and the secret weapon is permethrin, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's the stuff you can spray on your clothes ahead of time. and it won't eat your clothes and it's non-toxic and you'll get no bugs. So if you're in an area where there's going to be bugs or mosquitoes, I know I'm going on a 3-day bike pack up around Lake Tahoe the first weekend of June because I didn't get into Unbound. So I'm going to go bike pack, Promethean, Picardin. Those are your two things you want to spray on your clothes and on your body and not DEET. DEET works great. It just eats your Lycra. So protect that Velocio gear that you have paid.
That was such a terrific answer. And I think especially back to your first one with the rack. Yeah, there are some amazing racks out there. I think Tailfin is wildly popular right now. A swaying bag, a swaying saddle bag is so flipping annoying. And it's a really hard thing to prevent. And it's not until you've ridden day after day or hour after hour to really get it dialed. And that is why when you're going to get into bike packing, practice is so invaluable. You don't want to do an event and start up on the start line and then 2 hours in be like, oh gosh, my bike is swaying side to side. So it goes to show that why this question is so difficult, because there is no one piece of equipment that someone's like, aha, this is it. This is going to save your day.
Right.
But it's not really until you have this sort of practice and repetitivity to say, oh gosh, this is how to do it different. But both of yours were fantastic.
And part of the complication with bike packing versus backpacking or through hiking is in through hiking, you have this giant capacity backpack you can put items in where dimensions aren't quite as important. Mm-hmm. Whereas when we're bike packing, dimension is everything because you only have, you know, you have all kinds of space, handlebar bag, frame bag, seat bag. But you have to think dimension-wise of like, well, do I need that chair? Where would that chair even fit dimension-wise? And so you're 100% right. Just testing that stuff out, deciding what you need and where it will actually fit is key. So
it's a puzzle, 3D puzzle.
It is. And that's part of the fun, right? All right, next one. One of you guys want to lead off? Braden from Minneapolis.
Certainly. Braden from Minneapolis asks, or prefaces, this question was inspired by Laura's indoor rides, which end up on Strava. I hear a lot about how important it is to stay in specific power zones when training. But what I never hear is how hard it is to keep power consistent enough to stay within power zones. Outside of the general ride on flat terrain, quote unquote, do you have any practical tips on how to maintain better control over power zones while riding?
I feel like I would have some follow-up questions for this question to better understand why Braden is asking this. But Ted, maybe you can have some input in addition to what comes to mind for me. I think what comes to mind for me is I would be curious how long he has been a cyclist and how much riding he has done, because I think the longer you ride and the more fitness you gain, the more easy it is going to be to maintain your power because of time in the saddle and smoothness and efficiency in your pedal stroke. I guess outside of what he said, riding on flat terrain, I mean, one of the ways to practice even pedaling and even power and a good pedal stroke would be to take away any variation in terrain. So to do something like ride on the trainer is probably a really good practice for technique and for trying to maintain whatever power you are aiming for. The other thing I would say is like not to focus so much on a power zone or a number that it, I don't know. I think there's a point in which you can overanalyze what it means to stay in a power zone. And, you know, your power can really differ. Like if you're supposed to stay in an endurance zone for the day, if you're supposed to integrate some tempo, if you're supposed to integrate some VO2, there is a window for that and there will be variation. Sometimes it's helpful to kind of, you know, set your computer to show you what your average 3-second power is, because inevitably you're going to see so much variation. That number is not going to just stay exact, right? It's going to jump around. The point of, I think, the practice is to, at the end of your interval or at the end of whatever you're trying to do to hold a certain power, that your average power is within the window of whatever your goal is. So that's what comes to mind to me. What do you think, Ted?
I'm not a runner, but I think all day, ride on flat terrain is the kind of thing that a runner is going to feel when they just go for a jog, like a very easy jog, an all day jog. So as a non-runner, it's harder than a power walk, but it's easier than jogging, right? I mean, realistically, if I'm going to go for a jog, I get pretty tired after whatever, an hour. So maybe a terrible example, but you ride on flat terrain is your all day riding zone. And so, yeah, Laura has a great point that taking away a variable is really helpful, and not getting caught up in a particular number. I mean, if you're tired, if you've had a lot of caffeine, if you're underslept, if you're overhydrated, I mean, all these things can affect your zones. And so paying attention to your heart rate is also valuable. Or there's plenty of people who don't have any kind of metric measurable. So then you're doing it subjectively with perceived rate of exertion. And so then, you know, this is like a 2 out of 5. I mean, I'm getting into the weeds, but not getting hot up on power, I think, is very helpful from the beginning. I mean, I think to your point, it almost sounds like the kind of question one would ask if they got a trainer and they're getting into cycling, and then immediately you're offered power, which is something that cyclists of a previous generation didn't get until they'd ridden their bike for 20 years. It's almost like the age of Zwift. So, yeah, recognizing...
Yeah,
I was going to say, recognizing that it is a very, very easily fluctuatable number. We're used to heart rate, which is going to go up and down in very slow movements, whereas you can go from 1200 watts to 0 watts in a second. I mean, just how quickly watts go all over the place is fascinating. I don't know. Stu, how do you feel about this question? That's a tough one.
Oh, man, I would sit this one out. Mostly because my answer is just ride your bike.
Yeah.
Like, just enjoy riding your bike. And, you know, a talking pace is zone two. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it's these wild generalizations, right? But talking pace is zone two. And talking in short sentences is zone three. And grunting is zone four. It's just get out there and ride your bike. And I think coaching is amazing, and use coaching and do that stuff is wonderful. But at the end of the day, for us mere mortals, the goal is to get out and ride your bike and enjoy it and love it. So.
Oh, true. I will offer one other suggestion. And that is, if you're somebody who loves to analyze and you really want some specific training and feedback, I really enjoy Trainer Road for this reason. You know, you get a graph and you see exactly where your power is. And at the end of the day, you can go back and look at your workout and see exactly on that line where your power was fluctuating. And this is obviously when on the trainer, but that can be a good tool. Just even if you once a week, you have a trainer ride that you do, and tool that, you know, you can go back and kind of see where you have some weaknesses or where you might be missing the mark or where you're nailing your power perfectly. So that could be something that you check out if you have interest in digging in further there.
That's excellent. Anything else, folks? What do you think? Should we give it a wrap? This one even longer than expected. We thank you all very much for listening. We encourage you to subscribe, hit that subscribe button, give us a rating. Like I say, 5-star is appreciated. Share it with a friend, share it on social media. It's really fun to see this gaining some traction. Send the questions to gravelkingspodcast@gmail.com. Leave your address. We will mail you a sticker while supplies last. And we do have an Instagram. Give us a follow at gravelkingspodcast. So I think that's it, folks. Without further ado, Bye-bye.